Thank you very much indeed. You seem a long way away in the distance there. I hope you can hear me. Can you sort of wave if you can hear? This is encouraging. My dad always had bad hearing, and he was deaf in one ear. And he took a rather perverse pleasure in the fact that my mother started getting problems with her hearing, and he was thrilled when at last she got a hearing aid. And he told a joke against himself at that time. And the story goes like this. There's a man who's worried about his wife's hearing, but his wife is very sensitive about the matter. So he can never really raise it. He's finding it difficult to make the point that she can't hear very well. So he says to the doctor, "Doctor, my wife can't hear very well, and I need help to be able to point this out to her because she can't accept it." And the doctor said, "Well, here's a suggestion. Ask her a simple question. Start a certain distance away from her and see if she replies. And if she doesn't reply, she clearly hasn't heard, so go a little bit closer and ask her again. And if she doesn't reply, clearly she hasn't heard, you have to go a bit closer again. And then once she finally hears you, you can point out that you've asked the question a certain number of times and her hearing clearly isn't very good." He thinks that's a brilliant idea. So he starts a certain distance away and he asks his question, "What's for dinner tonight, darling?" No reply. Goes a little bit closer. "What's for dinner tonight, darling?" Still no reply. A bit closer. "What's for dinner tonight, darling?" Still no reply. Fourth time, "What's for dinner tonight, darling?" And at last he hears these words, "For the fourth time, it's roast lamb." So I hope you can hear in the big distance. It's an important subject that we're thinking about, and I know you've got these sheets that you were given as you came in. If God exists, why doesn't he show me? There were three Hindu boys that went away to university, and at the end of their first term, their father said to them, "Sons, what have you learned about God during your time at university?" And the first boy replied for about 5 minutes, all the things that he'd learned about God. The second boy spoke for about an hour, all the things he'd learned about God. And the third boy replied, "Father, I've learned nothing about God." And the father said, "You, my son, are the wisest. We can know nothing about God." There are lots of people who feel that they've tried to understand something about God, but they don't seem to be able to. And it may be that you feel you're in that group of people, and that's why you're here tonight. This question is very real for you personally. If God exists, why doesn't he show me? And perhaps you feel you'd long to know God, but he seems to be hiding from you. And some people seem to think that religion is a bit like a game of hide-and-seek. Do you play hide-and-seek in Malaysia with little children? I hope you do. I think it's a global game. It's a game that I used to love playing with my little nephews and nieces when they were little. I just spent time last week with my nephew who's now 6'5". He really is 6'5", and he's not little. But a few years ago, I remember him coming to stay in my parents' house, and we'd play hide-and-seek. It was not a difficult game, because children the world over tend to hide in exactly the same place every time. Have you noticed that? But there's a certain principle that you're meant to observe when you play the game hide and seek, if you're an adult. So you say, "I'll count to 30, and you count to 30, but you can hear the giggling, and you know exactly where he's gone, because he's always gone there before. But when the time stops, you then say, "Right, coming, ready or not?" And you're not meant to go straight to where he is. You pretend not to know. And you say, "I wonder if Tom is in the bathroom." Loud giggles from the bedroom next door, where he always is. And then you go in the next room. "I wonder if Tom's in the hallway." And then at last you go into the bedroom, and he's always under the bed. And you say, "I wonder if Tom's in the..." And even before the words are out, he's out from under the bed and he's in your arms. It's not a difficult game, is it? The adult who finds a brilliant hiding place and stays completely silent and remains there, not just for 5 minutes, but for 5 hours, has rather missed the point of the game. And some people seem to think that it's as if God is playing a game of hide and seek, but he's missed the point. He's found a brilliant hiding place, and he stays hidden. And here we human beings are, desperately looking for him, but he keeps entirely silent. That's what many people feel, and it may be that that's what you feel. And perhaps through difficult times in your life, you've asked the question, where is God? I know for some people it can be an academic question. You've looked at this question philosophically, and you don't seem to find answers. But there are others who ask this question very personally, and it may be that you're here tonight, and I want to take that very seriously. And it may be from a time of great pain in your own life, or sometimes harder is not when you're experiencing pain yourself, but when someone you love very much is experiencing pain. This question has burned in your soul. Where is God? If he really exists, why doesn't he show me? And the Bible has answers. And what the Bible's saying is, religion is not like a game of hide and seek where God is hiding. In fact, it's the other way around. The Bible's saying God is looking for us, but it's we human beings are hiding. In fact, the Bible begins with an account of the creation of everything. Christianity is very affirming of the natural world. It says that God made everything. And he made human beings in his image, uniquely of all the creation, able to relate to him and to know him. And he gave them an amazing permission. He said in the picture language of Genesis 2, you can eat of any of the trees in the garden. It's a very permissive God. But there's one tree which you're not allowed to eat from, which is the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. That's the tree that represents God's authority to define what is right and what is wrong, what is good and what is evil. God's in charge, in other words. But human beings turn away from God and they eat of that tree. And then what happens? Well, in Genesis 2, the second chapter of the Bible, we find God comes into the garden and he says these words, Adam, where are you? He's looking. But Adam is hiding. He's turning away. And there's something in the human heart that longs to know God, but there's something in the human heart that also runs away from God, because if I come to know God, I need to recognize that he is God, and that means changes to my life. And so if religion is a game of hide and seek, the Bible is saying God is looking for us. And he's come looking supremely in the person of his Son. That's the Christian claim. That Jesus Christ is the divine Son of God. And God in Christ has come looking for us. He's not hiding. That's the great truth that Christians celebrate at Christmas time. We gave you this bit of paper as you came in, and I'd like you to pick it up. And you see there some words from John's Gospel. That's John the Apostle, one of Jesus' closest friends, his account of the life and teaching of Jesus. And here, right towards the beginning of this gospel account, John says these words, "For the law was given through Moses. Grace and truth come through Jesus Christ. No one has ever seen God, but the one and only Son, who is himself God and is in closest relationship with the Father, has made him known." I've jotted down two phrases or sentences that sum up what I want to say, what I think is what John is saying. Number one, Jesus brings revelation from God. In other words, God is showing us himself in Jesus. It's there in those words in number 18, verse 18. No one has ever seen God, But the one and only Son, that's Jesus, who is himself God and is in closest relationship with the Father, has made him known. Now, I want you to imagine, this is an awful thought, really, but imagine that we were born inside this building and all our life has been inside this building and there are no windows. And we're having discussion this evening about whether there's anything out there beyond this building. And little groups of people are having a discussion about it. And then one by one, different people stand up and give us their view on whether there's anything beyond this building. And someone over here stands up and says with great conviction, "Yes, I'm absolutely convinced there's a whole world out there and it's full of green giants. That's the truth." Someone further back stands up and says, no, you're completely wrong. It's not a world of green giants. There's definitely something out there, and it's full of purple pygmies, little people. And then someone else over there, this is where the skeptics sit, and he stands up and says, no, you're all completely wrong. There's nothing out there. We've never seen anything out there. There is nothing out there. And this group, this is the very, very sensible, mature group. Am I right? Yes, those who are awake are agreeing with me. They say, "We've been sitting here patiently, but we've heard one person after the other proclaiming what they say is the truth. But let's be honest, we don't know. None of us have been outside. So the best we can do is guess. And by all means, make your guess that there is a world outside and it's full of green giants or purple pygmies or nothing. But can't we have the humility to acknowledge that it's just a guess and we might be wrong? We don't know." Well, let's say this room represents the world of space and time. And our question is there anything beyond this world? Is there a transcendent realm? And starting from within this world, we've just got to go with the evidence we might have. And some people might say, "Well, no, there's no God. From what we see inside this world of space and time, how can we believe in a God? Look at all the suffering. How can that fit with a God?" Someone else says, "Science is a perfectly adequate explanation of everything. We don't need to imagine some postulation of a God." And there are others who use evidence in another direction. They might point to the beauty of this world of space and time, the enormity of it, its intricacy, its order. And they say, "Surely that points to the fact that there's a God." They might particularly talk about human beings. And that might make you think. You see, if you are a materialist philosophically, then you are saying that you believe essentially in the eternal existence of matter and the non-existence of everything else. So you're saying that all that exists is the product of the impersonal matter, plus time, plus chance. And that means human personality, which is remarkably complex, you are saying, is the result of impersonality, triggered by a whole set of impersonal scientific processes, leading accidentally to who we are today. In other words, the profound complexity of human personality has emerged by accident from impersonality. You have to be saying, therefore, that matter without mind has produced within us reason and logic. Matter without morals has produced within us conscience and that hardwired sense of right and wrong. The matter without emotion has produced within us our loves and longings. That matter without design has produced within us, that insatiable hunger for meaning and purpose. Well, we could have that discussion. I think it's quite a profitable discussion. And the world over, people are having philosophical discussions about whether there's any evidence for God. And I think there is. But you can't prove it if you're just working from the internal world of space and time. For me, the evidence of the created world suggests surely this hasn't simply emerged by accident. And if I think that about the enormity of the world, I absolutely think that about the intricacy of the human personality. It doesn't make sense to me that it's simply emerged as a result of the impersonal, triggered by a set of impersonal accidents and scientific processes. But even if you end up concluding and guessing for within this closed world of space and time that there is a God, you're still left with the question, what kind of God is he? The Bible does speak about what theologians call general revelation. That actually we should have a sense from the world around us that there is a God who's made this astonishing creation and human beings. That there is within us a conscience that points to an objective sense of right and wrong from outside of us. And incidentally, if you reject any sense of a God, then you have to say that good and evil are purely subjective. There is no such thing as capital G good or capital G evil. It's just what feels good to me. But I think deep down we have a sense of right and wrong. Our conscience is pointed to this. But even if you agree with that evidence, you're still left with the question, well, what kind of God is it? And we can't answer that question for within the closed world of space and time. As John puts it in these words, no one has ever seen God. But let's extend the analogy for a moment. Do you remember the first question was, is there anything outside this building? And as we're discussing, we've got suggestion, green giants, purple pygmies, nothing, we can't be sure. As we're having that discussion, suddenly, through the door at the back, comes a man from outside. And he says, what have you been talking about? And we say, we've been discussing if there's anything out there. And he says, oh, I can tell you about that. I've just come from outside. There's a whole world out there full of very tall buildings and trees and birds and cars. Lots of cars, I've noticed, by the way, traveling very slowly. And we don't say to him, how arrogant of you to claim that you know the truth of what's outside. He's not guessing. He speaks with authority. He's come from outside. And John's claim is that Jesus is the man from outside. Those words again. No one has ever seen God, but the one and only Son, who is in self God and is in closest relationship with the Father, has made him known. The Christian claim is that God himself, in the person of his Son, has entered the world of space and time, which he created. And that's not just the Christian claim. It's the claim of Jesus of Nazareth. I don't know what you make of him. You know, there are more websites devoted to him than to Lady Gaga and Justin Bieber put together by a long way. He's been in more movies than James Bond. He never wrote a book, and yet he's the hero of history's number one bestseller, the Bible. Although in adulthood, he never traveled outside the country of his birth, he has more followers today worldwide than any other human being, living or dead. What do you make of him? It's extraordinary that this carpenter from a humble background is still the center of life for millions of people in our world today who follow him as their Lord, worship him as their God, and claim to know him as their friend. I'm one of them. It was when I was 18 that I began to follow Jesus Christ. I had a bit of a church background, but I'd never thought about him for myself. And I was moving away from Christian faith, but various things happened that made me decide I needed to make up my mind about him. So I picked up the Bible, and I read one of the New Testament accounts, one of the Gospels. And if you're someone who wants to understand Christianity, that's a great place to begin. Read one of the Gospel accounts of Jesus. And I did that, and I was amazed by what I read. I'd assumed that Jesus was a very good man. But the more I realized I could not simply describe him as a good man. He was either much more or much worse. The reason I say that is because of his claims. In John's Gospel, he makes these claims. He said, "I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father, God, except through me." He said, "But before Abraham was, thousands, hundreds of years before, I am, I've always been," he's saying. Again and again, he's claiming to be divine. Now, someone who claims to be divine is not just a good man. He could be much worse. He could be deliberately inventing the claim to try and get a following. And there have been certainly people who've made claims to get people to follow them, and they make a lot of money. You can make money out of religion. But Jesus never made any money out of his teaching. It took him to his death. So then there's another alternative. Maybe he was just sadly deluded. But he certainly wasn't just a good man. I mean, suppose this evening you came here, and instead of talking about Jesus, I talked about myself. And I said something like this: "I'm so glad you're here this evening. You've made the best decision of your life to hear me, Vaughan Roberts. Because, by the way, do you want to know what God looks like? Look at me. And you'd better listen very carefully to what I've got to say, because your eternal destiny depends on how you respond to me, Vaughan Roberts." At the end of the evening, if you stayed sitting down throughout my talk, which is unlikely, and you turned to your husband or wife or friend at the end of the evening, I doubt you'd say, "What a good man that Vaughan Roberts was." If you had an ounce of compassion, you might be ringing the nearest hospital and say, "There's a man here who needs help." And yet those are the kind of things that Jesus said about himself. All the other religious leaders the world over have pointed away from themselves. Do you want to know God? You need to read this holy book. Do you want to know God? You need to go to that holy place. Jesus Christ said, "Do you want to know God? You need to come to me." And I was amazed as I read the New Testament Gospels to find these astonishing claims and the evidence backed up those claims. See, God is not hiding in Christian understanding. He's come to earth in the person of his son, Jesus. He lived an amazing life, like no one else has ever lived. Love just poured out of him to young and old, to male and female, to rich and poor. He performed astonishing miracles. He just seemed to be able to flick his fingers, and the blind could see, the lame could walk, even the dead were raised. His life, his miracles, and the greatest miracle of all, his resurrection from the dead, backed up this extraordinary claim. So there's the Christian claim. Jesus brings revelation from God. And so when, through a hard time in my life, I might be asking, where is God? I don't have all the answers. There'll be times when I don't understand why God allowed that terrible thing to happen. There's much we don't understand. But as a Christian, I look at Jesus Christ, and I see a perfect revelation of God. And I know he cares. He doesn't look at the suffering of the world and send his condolences by an email or a WhatsApp message. He comes in the person of his son. He experiences suffering himself. He understands, and he pours his love on people. There's the first claim. Jesus brings revelation from God. And there's a second claim. Jesus offers relationship with God. So the claim is he doesn't just help us to know about God, he actually helps us come to know him. There's a British novelist called Julian Barnes who's an atheist. And he once made this revealing comment. He said, "I don't believe in God, but I miss him. I miss him." I live in Oxford, and Oxford is where Richard Dawkins, perhaps the world's most famous atheist, lives. And you might think that there are lots of people like Richard Dawkins in a place like Oxford, an academic university town. I meet very, very few of them. There's a small number of quite aggressive atheists, but it's just a small number. I meet more people who might be agnostic or some who might say something like that. "I'm not sure I do believe in God," but actually, if they're honest with themselves, are saying, I wish I could. Because there's a recognition of a hunger in the human heart that nothing in this world can satisfy. I wonder if you've noticed that the kind of things that people, no doubt many of us, seek to live for can never ultimately satisfy. Someone lives for pleasure. I've even heard people say, "If only I could have this experience, then I'd die a happy man, I'd die a happy woman. If only I could go and visit that country, or have that encounter, or meet that person." Do you think they are satisfied when that pleasure has been experienced? Not at all. They might have a moment of euphoria, and then it leaves an emptiness. Or success. When I was a schoolboy, I had modest ambitions. I wanted to get to Cambridge University, and I wanted to be the captain of the squash team, the racket sport. I achieved both ambitions on the same day, and there was an amazing sense of euphoria. The next day, I've never been more depressed in my life. And I think it was because I thought I'd be satisfied, then I'd be really happy. And those things happened to me, and they left an emptiness. Jack Higgins, the British novelist who sold millions of novels around the world, was once asked what he wished he'd known at the age of 21 that he now knows. And he said, "I wish I'd known that when you get to the top, there's nothing there." He'd always assumed if he achieved his ambitions, then he'd be satisfied. He got them, and he wasn't. And so many people live for money. And they think, "If only I could get a bit more money, then I'd be happy." John D. Rockefeller, one of the richest men of the 20th century, was once asked, "How much money does it take for someone to be really satisfied?" He replied, "Just a little bit more." Doesn't matter how much you've got. You want a little bit more. And why is it that nothing in this world seems to satisfy us? Isn't that a pointer that we were made for something beyond this world, or at least, as the Bible's saying, made to relate to the God who made us? We're designed for relationship with Him. And that's what Jesus came to offer. I love the story of the fish that was devised. By the way, this is not a true story. It'll become pretty clear soon, I think. But the story goes, there was this fish that was devised by scientists to live out of water. And the scientists were very, very pleased that they'd managed to do this. They chose a red herring for the experiment, and they developed this fish that could live out of water. And they were so pleased that they took the fish on a world tour to show it off to the surrounding nations. It was a triumphant success. Until one day, disaster happened. The fish fell into a pool of water. Well, it couldn't breathe, of course. Every reflex said no to that. It kept its eyes and its gills clamped firmly shut. Never did a fish so wet feel more like a fish out of water. But after a while, it just had to breathe. And so the red herring drew a tentative gillful. Its eyes bulged, it flicked a fin. It wiggled with delight and it darted away. The fish had discovered water. And with that same kind of wonder, human beings, conditioned by a world that rejects Him, discover God. For as the Bible puts it, in Him we live and move and have our being. In Him is life. The Bible's saying we were designed to live in the environment of a relationship with God. Just as a fish is designed to live in water, human beings are designed to relate to the God who made us. And starved of that relationship, we're hungry, we're thirsty, and we look all over the place for other things to satisfy that hunger, to satisfy that thirst, but nothing satisfies. We remain, as it were, gasping for breath. We're made to relate to God. The Bible says we can come to a relationship with God. Now, any religion is bound to address the question, how is it that human beings can come into a relationship with God? And many say the way is through something that you do. And Christianity says no. That will never work. Just glance again at the words from John's Gospel. For the law was given through Moses, who received the revelation of the Ten Commandments from God. Grace and truth come through Jesus Christ. There are those who think that the way to be right with God is through the law. So there are the Ten Commandments that God has given. And they think the way to be right with God is to obey God's law, and then I'll earn friendship with God as a reward. The trouble is, none of us obey the law. A friend of mine was speaking in a school, and he said, none of us have obeyed God's commandments, and none of us can obey God's commandments. One pupil came up afterwards and said, I admit I haven't always obeyed all of the commandments up to now, but I can do it. So my friend who was giving Christian talks in the school for a week said, okay, you've got a week. So tell me at the end of the week if you've managed to do it. He noticed that the boy stayed rather hidden from him. Eventually he found him at the end of the week, and the boy said, no, I haven't been able to do it. He tried very hard, but he couldn't. Just think about some of the commandments. Don't steal. And perhaps you think, I'm not a shoplifter. I'm not a thief. Well, let me ask you this. Have you never stolen anything in your life? Never a pencil? Have you ever cheated? back as a pupil at school. Never cheated, because cheating is stealing marks, isn't it? The Bible says, don't commit adultery. And some of you think, no, I've done that. But there would be others, plenty of others, who'd say, no, I've never committed adultery. But listen to what Jesus said. He said, anyone who looks at another person lustfully has already committed adultery in his heart. Because God is not just looking at the outward act. God sees our hearts. And which of us could say that we've never committed adultery in our hearts? God says, don't murder. And I reckon most of us think, oh, well, I'm okay there. I don't think we've got many murderers here. And yet Jesus Christ said, when anyone looks at another person dismissively and said, you utter idiot, they've committed murder in their hearts, because God sees the heart. And you know, the first commandment is, you shall have no other gods before me. We should worship God alone. And Jesus summarized the beginnings of the commandments by saying, you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind, and with all your strength. Which of us could possibly say we've done that? Judged against the standards of God's law, we are found wanting. And when a religion says the way to come to relationship with God is by obeying certain standards, it ends us with despair or self-delusion, because God is so perfect and we fall so far short, we don't live up to those standards. It just condemns us. But listen to those words again. The law was given through Moses. Grace and truth came through Jesus Christ. Grace. It's a wonderful word. It means undeserved love. You could say there are two kinds of religion in the world. There are two-letter religions, and there are four-letter religions. The two-letter religions will say, D-O. Here's what you've got to do. And Christianity is saying, you will never be able to do enough, because God is so perfect and we fall so far short that we will never earn our way before God. The law, doing, will not work. What Christianity offers is grace. Not two letters, but four letters. D-O-N-E. Not do, but done. See, Jesus Christ came not just to reveal God, but to rescue people. And the problem is that God is so perfect and we fall so far short that we are cut off from him, rightly. So how can we come to know this God? And Jesus lived a perfect life. He's the one person who ever lived who always obeyed the commandments from the very heart. He's the one person who ever lived who didn't deserve to face the penalty, the judgment of separation from God for disobedience. And the Christian claim is that on the cross, Jesus took upon himself the punishment, the wrongdoing of the world, so that all who trust in him can come to know him, God through him, not on the basis of what they do, but on the basis of what he has done. That's offered for everyone. But there's a challenge, you see. Because once I see Jesus Christ and recognize him for who he is, and he offers me a free gift and says, you can come to know me and know my Father simply by trusting that I died for you. He's not offering simply salvation. He's also saying, now follow me as your Lord. And that's a challenge. And so when Jesus was on earth, so many people turned away from him. He was challenging to them. They didn't want to give up their independence and submit to him as Lord. And so John in this gospel says, here's the strange thing. He said, this is the truth. Light has come into the world, but men loved darkness instead of light because their deeds were evil. So before we have an opportunity for questions, I want to leave you with this thought. Yes, it's true that some people have real intellectual questions about God and about Christian faith. I don't want to deny that at all. But I do want to ask the question, could it be that sometimes our frustration that God is not there or our problems with God are less to do with our intellect and more to do with the fact that we don't want to give up the throne of our lives? We don't want to change, because to come into the light means turning our backs on the kind of things that Jesus died to deal with. So as I conclude, here's the Christian claim. Jesus brings revelation from God, and Jesus offers relationship with God. And that's on offer for everyone. I know you'll be in different positions today, some of you starting a long way back with big questions, and I'd encourage you to ask your questions as we talk now. Maybe to keep coming and meeting with Christians, come to a Christianity Explored course and ask your questions. But there may be others who actually deep down know these things are true, and the challenge for you is to come into the light and put your trust in Jesus. Thank you so much for listening. I don't want to go any more because I want to give you plenty of time to ask questions. And so here is Vince positively leaping towards the front, and he's going to tell us what happens next.
Well, thank you very much, Vaughan, for a wonderful talk.